This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
I'm Margaret Brennan in Washington. And this week on Face the Nation, the standoff between Democrats on Capitol Hill continues, and our COVID death toll reaches a grim new milestone. Last week was a revealing look into Washington's ways as Democratic budget battles reached new lows, and tensions within the party are at new highs. House progressives, backed by the president, won this round as they blocked a vote on that $1 trillion infrastructure bill that passed the Senate in August with bipartisan support. It's not that they don't like it. They're holding it up until all Democrats get on board with a massive $3.5 trillion bill devoted to spending for social programs and climate change. Moderate Democrats in the Senate, like West Virginia's Joe Manchin and Arizona's Kyrsten Sinema, say that's a price tag that's too high.
This is not giving out money. This is not spending. This is investing, and this is building the state that we both love.
And they're both feeling the heat from the left.
And all they need to do is we have to elect more, I guess, for them to get theirs, elect more liberals.
So is President Biden. He spent the week huddling with Democrats in Washington and announced he's going on a road trip to sell his proposals.
Like we had hurricanes and floods, and we had little things like we had. Anyway, a lot was going on.
The president says he's been busy, but promised a new focus on his domestic agenda.
Biden vowed he's going to do this. Biden's going to work like hell to make sure we get both these passed. And I think we'll get them passed.
Can he unite the party and fix the mess that's become the subject of late night jokes?
Can't we compromise on anything? Isn't something better than nothing?
The real representative, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, will be here, and we'll ask her that very question. Plus, New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker on prospects for police reform. He'll respond to our interview last week with South Carolina Republican Tim Scott. And although Delta variant cases are finally starting to slow, West Virginia is in crisis. We'll talk with West Virginia Governor Jim Justice, Dr. Anthony Fauci, and former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb. It's all just ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning, and welcome to Face the Nation. These are interesting times here in Washington. We're used to the political battles being back and forth between Republicans and Democrats. But today, we find ourselves in an increasingly polarized debate between Democrats, the factions within the party, the progressives or liberals, and the moderates. We asked some of the key moderates on both sides of Congress to join us this morning, and they didn't take us up on our invitation. But we do begin today with a key progressive, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Congresswoman, it is great to have you here in studio.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So you have this standoff right now. How real is the risk that the Democrats end up with nothing?
You know, I know that, I believe that the entire party is committed in delivering for this country. And I know that our caucus, the House Democratic Caucus, is entirely focused on delivering for this country. But I think the question that we're having right now, and the reason why we are having this discussion right now, is because we don't want to leave communities behind. And all too often, DC politics, you know, when we have to make a compromise, the folks that get compromised are lower income, working class families, it's healthcare, it's relief, it's communities of color. And we want to make sure that we're fighting for all of us, not just some of us.
Which is why you're using your leverage right now to hold up the other $1 trillion infrastructure bill. But the head of your caucus, the Progressive Caucus, was on another network this morning. And Representative Jayapal said,
$1.5 trillion is just too small. That's the number that Senate moderates Joe Manchin in particular want to get down to. President Biden, according to our reporting from Ed O'Keefe, our correspondent, says you're going to have to settle for about $2 trillion. Is that an acceptable ceiling for you?
So here's where I think the problem is that when we talk about top line numbers, there's a lot that is hidden in that discussion. And so the reason why this conversation shouldn't be about numbers, but it should be about what substantive programs are willing to be excluded or that...
That's coming from the White House.
Yeah, but the White House isn't making the demands to exclude universal child care or universal pre-K. This is coming from the more conservative wing of the Democratic Party. And those are the conversations that we need to have, because the thing is that Washington math is notoriously funny. And you can make a $1 trillion bill into $2 trillion. You can make a $3 trillion bill that helps fewer people, et cetera. And so that's why we really need to talk about the substance of this. The budget bill that House progressives are trying to fight for, the Biden Build Back Better agenda, includes universal pre-K, free community college, expansion of Medicare. We're fighting for expansion of Medicaid. And these are the things that we are saying, in addition to the very real climate threat that we have, emissions reductions, are worth standing up for.
But a $2 trillion ceiling, that means you're going to have to maneuver here somewhere. Mm-hmm. The head of your caucus said this morning you're looking at shorter funding periods for programs. So instead of chopping, sort of nipping and tucking.
Yes.
So
yes.
What is non-negotiable there for you?
So, you know, you bring up an excellent point in that the fact is that we do have to compromise with the fact that we have Senator Manchin and Sinema who refuse to support certain programs for working families. And so the compromises and the options that we have before us is, do we shorten our funding programs? Do you reduce the level of funding? Do you cut programs out together? I think that one of the ideas that's out there is fully fund what we can fully fund, but maybe instead of doing it for 10 years, you fully fund it for 5 years, or you fully fund it.
What are you thinking of when you throw that out as an example?
So I think, there's there's so many different programs in the budget bill. First of all, I think it's unfortunate that we have to even, as Democrats, have a discussion about not having a child tax credit. I think it's unfortunate that we have to compromise with ourselves for an ambitious agenda for working people. I believe that free community college should be a standard. We should have K through 14. But this is one bill, and perhaps we can vote for more down the line. And we've discussed with the president about that, continuing that funding. But there's a wide variety of those programs, and I would encourage folks in their community to also reach out to their elected officials to let them know what programs they want to make sure are kept. But I think there are some things that are that are very, very important to us.
What is non-negotiable?
You know, I think some of the climate provisions that we have, we cannot afford to increase carbon or just fossil fuel emissions at this time. That is simply the science. That is not something we can kick down the line. Right now, both the IPCC report saying that this is code red for humanity, as well as recent reporting saying that if you're under 40, like myself, like millions of Americans, you will be seeing a catastrophic increase in the
amount. You're going to run right into Senator Joe Manchin on those issues, mm-hmm. though. You know that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I think Senator Manchin's going to run into the science as well.
So what do you think that means? And he also has said for him, this bill will be dead on arrival if it does not include the Hyde Amendment, which mm-hmm. would ban federal funding for abortion. Mm-hmm.
So I think what we're seeing here is a dynamic where progressives are trying to skin this cat 9 different ways, but moderates are not really coming to the table. I don't even want to call them moderates, because there's a lot of moderates in the party that don't like being associated with some of this hardline tactics. It's a very tiny cadre of conservative Democrats. But I mean, this is the issue, is that we're saying, okay, we're going down from $6 trillion to $3 trillion. Mm-hmm. Now it's $1 trillion. And we have some of these conservatives that say, well, our line is zero. And you're lucky if you get one. And this isn't, I want to ground this conversation because this isn't a tit for tat between personality. This is not about me and Senator Manchin. Mm-hmm. This is about families in the Bronx. This is about people who need to take a bus to drop their kid off at school, and they're not going to be able to go back to work because they don't have childcare to go back to work.
But it is a question about the vision for the Democratic Party. And last year, you were very, very frank during the presidential race. You said in any other country, Joe Biden and I would not even be in the same party. But in America, we are. Mm-hmm. Has Joe Biden proved himself progressive enough for you now?
Yeah, you know, I think and those comments are referring to parliamentary systems in other countries where there's a lot more diversity. We don't have a two-party duopoly in other countries the way that we do in ours. But I think that President Biden has been a good faith partner to the entire Democratic Party. He is, in fact, a moderate, and we disagree on certain issues. But he reaches out, and he actually tries to understand our perspective, and that is why I am fighting for his agenda mm-hmm. with the Build Back Better Act.
Are you surprised that he hasn't been able to deliver those Senate moderates that you're having those problems with?
No. I think that for quite some time, we have seen that some of these conservatives in the party, you know, this is not about a team. It's about, you know, individual sort of preferences, but that is okay. You know, we're going to come together. I believe in the vision and commitment of mm-hmm. our party for working people. And the thing is that we have to respect all families and all voters.
Well, lastly, just, you know, these moderates in the House as well, not just Senator Manchin, would say you're not playing for the team when you mm-hmm. hold one bill hostage, as they would say, mm-hmm. for the other, and put a bill that has roads and bridges and jobs potentially at risk.
Well, the agreement several months ago to even proceed on that one bipartisan bill was that it was tied with our larger Build Back Better agenda. And the reason when some folks say, well, why can't you just pass this and we'll see everything else later? First of all, we do not, you know, both of these bills need to pass. Both will not pass if people try to separate them. If we try to diverge from that agreement that was settled several months ago, we can't simply invent new terms midstream and then expect everyone else that those initial terms to hold. I'm willing to hold up my end of the bargain by sticking to both. And we need to expect all of our lawmakers who are part of that deal to stick to that bargain.
Congresswoman, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
We turn now to COVID, the pandemic, and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the president's chief medical advisor. Good morning to you, Dr. Fauci.
Good morning.
700,000 American dead. This is now the worst pandemic the country has ever experienced. Are we close to over, or do we need to brace for another wave?
Well, you know, one of the things we want to make sure is that we have had over the last few weeks a turning around of the acceleration of this starting to come down in cases and hospitalizations and soon deaths. The one thing that we don't want to do is that we don't want to become complacent and say, okay, now we need to pull back. We don't need any more people to get vaccinated. We Right. need to continue to get those individuals, now 70 million people who are eligible to be vaccinated, because if you look at the history, Margaret, mm-hmm. of the different surges we've had, it's come up, start to come down, and then all of a sudden, boom, come back up again. As it's coming down, we have within our capability, we can make this happen, namely go down to a very, very low level with vaccination and with mitigation. So that's the one thing I want to make sure that our viewers realize, that we've done well in the sense of getting 55% of the population fully vaccinated and 64% with at least one dose. But we've got to keep pushing on the vaccination front.
Okay. You said don't let your guard down. There are two new studies out that show COVID's gotten better at transmitting through aerosols, just through the air. What does that mean? We're going into cold weather. We're going into the holidays. Do people need to start looking around and saying it's just too risky to gather with family members if there are unvaccinated children?
Well, Margaret, I believe just the way the CDC has recommended, that when you are in a situation where you have a dynamics of virus in the community where there's clearly a lot of spread, even if you are vaccinated and you are in an indoor setting, a congregate setting, it just makes sense to wear a mask and to avoid high-risk situations. And what we should be doing is look at ventilation in indoor places. We know now that this is clearly spread by aerosol. And when you have something spread by aerosol, you absolutely want more ventilation, which is the reason why outdoors is always much safer than indoors. And if you are indoors, ventilation is going to be key. And that's the reason why we really should be paying attention to that.
But we can gather for Christmas, or it's just too soon to tell?
You know, Margaret, it's just too soon to tell. We've just got to concentrate on continuing to get those numbers down and not try to jump ahead by weeks or months and say what we're going to do at a particular time. Let's focus like a laser on continuing to get those cases down. And we can do it by people getting vaccinated, and also in the situation where boosters are appropriate, to get people boosted, because we know that they can help greatly in diminishing infection and diminishing advanced disease, the kinds of data that are now accumulating in real time.
The president announced nearly a month ago that businesses need to mandate vaccines for their employees or submit them to weekly testing. We looked, it's been a month. None of this paperwork has been filed with OSHA to make that happen. Was this a stunt? Are you seeing companies follow through even without the legal mandate filed?
I think some of them are, and I think you'll be seeing a lot more once we get past these legal issues. I think what the president said about companies greater than 100 individuals is a good thing, and you're seeing also local groups, universities, and businesses are doing that.
But you're speaking with immediacy. But when you're speaking with immediacy, it doesn't seem reflected in the action here.
Well, certainly, if you look at universities now, we've had, I believe, Margaret, if I'm not mistaken, close to 1,000 or more universities are saying that if you want to be on campus with real-time classes, you really have to get vaccinated or you can't come. And there are businesses that are doing that. I mean, airlines, look at airlines, the mandate of the airlines, where you have now 99% of certain airlines employees are vaccinated.
Yeah.
So when you do that, when you tell people that there are alternatives, that if you do not want to get vaccinated, you're not going to work or you're not going to be able to go to school, I think that the emergent nature of what we're dealing with actually does justify that.
We've seen such an uptick in infections among kids and low uptake of the vaccine in that 12 to 17 range. California just mandated it as of January is the estimate. Do you think other states should follow suit?
Well, I agree with what Governor Newsom did in California. I mean, I'm not going to getting into the local issues, only to talk about general principles, that people need to realize that having a vaccine requirement for schools is not a new novel thing that is very peculiar or specific to COVID-19. We've been doing this for decades. My own children could not have gone to school if they had not gotten vaccinated with the measles, mumps, and rubella. So when we see pushback on that, it's as if this never happened before. It's actually ongoing with other vaccines. So let's do it with a virus that's very, very serious. Mm-hmm. And as you just mentioned with the numbers, Margaret, has caused an unprecedented number of deaths and infections in this country.
We had news this week from Merck that they have this new pill they submitted to the FDA that can reduce the chances of hospitalization if you get COVID. The government's purchased 1.7 million doses. That doesn't seem like nearly enough. Why didn't the government place a bigger bet on this drug?
Well, I think the government placed a good bet on it. You know, when some people were saying, well, it's no proof at all or even indication it's going to work. We went ahead and purchased 1.7. We have the option for millions more. And now that we have this success, the company certainly is going to rev up and make tens and tens of millions more for the rest of the world and for us. So it's good news. And I think we were very prescient in making that determination way back of making a purchase of 1.7 million.
You don't, we're talking millions, trillions these days. No, understood. But you don't worry that in the immediate term, the American government will be pushed to the back of the line before these foreign governments have their new purchase orders filled?
You know, I don't think so, Margaret, at all. I mean, I think this is good news, and I think it's going to be an important addition to our armamentarium. What I won't want people to be doing is to saying, well, now that we have a drug, we don't need to get vaccinated.
Right.
The easiest way to not get in a hospital and not die is to not get infected in the first place.
All right. Dr. Fauci, thank you for your time this morning. Overall, two-thirds of Americans over 18 are fully vaccinated, and a new study last week determined unvaccinated Americans were 8 times more likely to get the Delta variant than those who are unvaccinated, and were 57 more times more likely to die. West Virginia is one state in crisis due to the Delta variant, and their vaccination rate is considerably below the national average. Republican Governor Jim Justice joins us. Governor, you were leading the pack out of the gate, and now you've hit this wall. Why aren't you able to convince more of your constituents to go get immunized?
Well, Margaret, we're a long ways from being in crisis in West Virginia. If you look at our death rate compared to the national average, we're still below the national average with our death rate. We got out of the gate right,
Your hospitals are getting overwhelmed.
I'm sorry?
Your hospitals are getting overwhelmed. You have a high infection rate.
We're overwhelmed all across this country. I mean, for crying out loud, you know, West Virginia is managing it absolutely great. And in every way, from the standpoint of getting out first and vaccinating our people first in West Virginia, we wish that the boosters would have come along sooner, because we got out so early that really and truly we were at the 6 month situation way before. And think about this for just 1 second, Margaret.
Well,
on Tuesday or Wednesday of this coming week, we will have given and administered every single one of our Pfizer vaccines to every nursing home we have in the state.
But Governor,
you know, to say West Virginia's in a crisis is wrong. That's just all there is.
Governor, you just asked the Biden administration for more monoclonal antibodies, which is one of the treatments for people who are hospitalized with this virus, and they denied it. You need that because people are very sick. Are you concerned that your request was denied?
Well, sure, we're concerned. It weren't denied. It was just lowered. But with all that, you know, Margaret, the reality is the supply. You know, the southern states just gobbled up all the supply and everything. And again, the Biden administration is standing there holding the bag. We need more antibodies here, but we're managing it.
You were talking about your dispute of characterization of where you are with vaccinations, but you do seem to have hit a wall with the younger people in your state. You've done all these things with mascots, with your bulldog, baby dog. You've got giving away guns. You're giving away these things. Why can't you increase vaccinations?
Well, I just think about it. You know, since we came out with our campaign with a little old English bulldog, a baby dog, you know, that's got a face that makes everybody smile, and she loves everybody. You know, but with all that, we have vaccinated hundreds of thousands of more West Virginians. It's been tremendously successful. You know, all of us all across this nation hit a wall.
Yeah.
We all know that the more we get vaccinated, the more we'll live. We all know that.
Governor,
but at the same time, we protect our freedoms, do we not?
We're going to talk more on the other side of this break, so stay with us.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. We want to continue our conversation with West Virginia Governor Jim Justice. Governor, let's pick up where we left off, which was how your state is faring right now with vaccinations and with COVID. Your health officials, Dr. Clay Marsh, at a press conference just this week, talked about how much your medical system is under strain right now, saying the number of COVID cases and hospitalizations is higher than it has been during the entire pandemic. And you yourself said you're right in the eye of the storm. So what's the problem? Why aren't people protecting themselves?
Well, Margaret, they are. You know, I mean, we are in the eye of the storm. We're right at the peak of the surge right now. And from our hospital standpoint, we're absolutely, you know, we're still doing elective surgeries and we're still doing all that. We're not overloaded from the standpoint of our hospitals, you know, having to turn people down and all that. We're absolutely, you know, are managing this and managing it in a right way. But we are right at the peak of our surge here, and we're very hopeful that it's starting to decline. It's declining in certain ways, but we're still going to be very, very vigilant in what we do.
You yourself at your press conference this week encouraged parents to vaccinate their children. California's governor's mandating kids 12 to 17 get a vaccine to go into the schoolroom after around January. Are you going to mandate it for school kids as well?
No chance.
Why?
No chance.
Why? You mandate as governor. As governor, you mandate. We looked. Measles, mumps, rubella, tetanus, polio, other vaccines. Why won't you put COVID on that list?
Now, Margaret, you know, you don't have to come in so hot. You guys asked me to come, you know. But, Margaret, the bottom line of the whole thing is just this. I truly believe that the mandates only divide us and only divide us more. From the standpoint of mandates, I don't believe in imposing upon our freedoms over and over and over. And I've said that over. I don't know how many times I got to say it. Mm-hmm. But from the standpoint of our children, I'm going to still encourage in every way, because I truly believe that the more people that we get vaccinated, the less people will die. But at the same time, we still got to stand up for who we are. For crying out loud, we're Americans.
I know this has become a big issue for the Republican Party, which you are a part of, in terms of framing this as a freedom of choice. But for small children, you mandate that their parents get them those immunizations so that they are safe in the classroom. They don't have freedoms as children to choose whether or not to get polio or not. We protect them against that. Why don't you want to protect those children by mandating it?
Margaret, to think or that I don't want to protect the children is ridiculous. I mean, we all want to protect our children. But parents have decisions to make in this situation, too, just like the local officials have decisions to make. For crying out loud, you know, that's who should be making these decisions is the parents, you know, and
well,
from the standpoint
of the federal
government. Well,
you'd make those decisions as a governor, actually.
Well, we can go on and on about this forever, but in this situation, we're not going to change. And really and truly, it never has really mattered to me. You know, I do think this nation is so divided from the standpoint of partisanship, it's unbelievable. And right now, what you had AOC say just earlier, you know, our team needs to be better. Well, you elect individuals. You don't elect a team. You elect individuals to come to Washington and voice their opinions.
Yeah.
Not elect a party. You know, you elect individuals.
Right. Well, Governor, thank you very much for your time today. Only about a third of the world's population is fully vaccinated against COVID, with developing countries lagging far behind. Elizabeth Palmer will have the latest from London.
Good morning. We passed another global milestone in the pandemic this week. 5 million people have now died from COVID-19. But in Britain, where the London Marathon went ahead this morning, for the first time in 2 years, fewer people are dying. In fact, thanks to high vaccine uptake across Europe, the death rate here is less than half what it is in America. Not so in Russia, which has had record COVID deaths this weekend. Fewer than one in three Russians have been vaccinated. When a descendant of the Russian royal family was married in St. Petersburg, there were 1,500 guests and not a mask in sight. This is typical. Many Russians believe natural antibodies give both adequate protection and bragging rights. Here's Vladimir Putin telling Turkey's President Erdogan his antibody level is 16. Erdogan responds, mine's 100. In Israel, by contrast, vaccines, three of them including the booster, is the new normal for everyone over 12. That's coverage the developing world can only dream of. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala heads the World Trade Organization.
While nearly 60% of people in developed countries are fully vaccinated, in Africa the figure is barely 4%.
African leaders want countries like the U.S. to lift vaccine export controls to free up millions of doses. But in the wealthy West, the rituals of life as we knew it are returning. In France, la bise, the kiss on the cheek, is back. That is as long as a vaccine-resistant mutation of the virus doesn't emerge, but epidemiologists are saying that's still a very real possibility. Margaret?
Elizabeth Palmer in London, thank you. We go now to former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb, who also sits on the board of Pfizer. He is the author of Uncontrolled Spread, Why COVID-19 Crushed Us and How We Can Defeat the Next Pandemic. Dr. Gottlieb, always good to talk to you. I want to pick up with you where I left off with Governor Justice, which was on this question of vaccine mandates for children. He didn't like the comparison of the COVID-19 vaccine to all the other vaccines he mandates as a governor. Measles, mumps, rubella, tetanus, polio. Should it be considered different?
Well, I think it's inevitable that the COVID vaccine is going to be incorporated into the childhood immunization schedule. CDC ultimately has to take that up. My guess is they're not going to take that up until you have fully approved vaccines for children, until you have more than one vaccine in the market available to kids. So that might be more of a fall 2021-2022 type of event. But you're going to see other states and local districts moving forward with their own mandates. And I think the right locus for decision making around these mandates is at the local level. So you're going to see other states like California taking this up.
Right, which they did. But Governor Justice, what you're talking about is a practical matter of timing. He said it's about personal freedom and parents making decisions for themselves. And it's a theme that we continue to hear, particularly from Republicans. Senator Ted Cruz this week said he stands with NBA players refusing to be vaccinated, for example. The Republican governor of Texas, Florida, they're saying it also. It's a matter of free choice. You've been concerned about politicization of vaccines. Aren't we already there?
We are there. Look, these are not just individual choices. These are collective decisions. And we've always looked at vaccination as a collective decision. That's why we have a childhood immunization schedule, because your behavior with respect to your choice around vaccination affects your community. That's why I think the right locus of decision making around these mandates is as local a level as possible. So to the extent that governors and mayors can do this, I think that's going to depoliticize these kinds of decisions. It's when the federal government steps in that this becomes more of a political issue. I do worry about the consequences of the moment we're in, the fact that now vaccination is something that's dividing us culturally and politically, because I think that's going to have broader implications than just around COVID. I worry that going forward, we're going to see vaccination rates decline as this becomes more of a political football, and we see people, literally governors, running against vaccine and vaccine mandates in the next presidential cycle. That's going to be deleterious to the public health generally, if that's what comes out of this episode we're in.
And that was your, if I understand it, your chief criticism of President Biden's decision a month ago to issue a mandate, one he hasn't filed for yet, but at least announced.
Yeah, I would be trying to use big carrots rather than sticks when it comes to private businesses. I think that that's where they might have crossed the line that really created more acrimony and gave people on a political right, frankly, something to now run against. Certainly the federal government's well within its right with the mandates on federal workers. I think healthcare workers should be mandated to get vaccinated. We require them to get vaccinated for chickenpox and hepatitis B and influenza. I think a mandate inside the Medicare program makes a lot of sense, using the Medicare program to try to incentivize Medicare providers to get their populations vaccinated at higher levels. That's going to protect a lot of senior citizens. So there's certainly tools that the federal government has at its disposal. But I think when you get shutting down a private business within states, you want to see those decisions made by the businesses at the local level. And I think the federal government could step in with incentives to try to drive that behavior.
Mm-hmm. We asked Dr. Fauci about this pill from Merck that was announced as being successful 50% of the time in reducing by half the chance of hospitalization. 1.7 million doses. Are you concerned that's not enough?
Well, it's not enough. 1.7 million doses by virtue of the indication that this is probably going to be approved for would cover us with 1 month of the Delta wave. I mean, it would have covered 1 month of the Delta wave in the South. So I think there could have been a little more forethought to trying to get more manufacturing in place and procuring more doses. Just to give you a basis of comparison, the Strategic National Stockpile has anywhere between 50 million and 80 million courses of therapy for a feared pandemic flu. So, you know, contracting for 1.7 million doses wasn't enough to cover any appreciable portion of this pandemic. This drug looks very promising. This is the most profound treatment effect based on the top line data that I've seen from an orally available drug in the treatment of any respiratory pathogen. So, you know, hopefully Merck is going to be in a position to file the data with FDA this week. They can make an emergency use authorization request as early as this week. Mm-hmm. And depending on how long the FDA takes, and the FDA has seen a lot of this data already, you could see this drug available very soon.
Is it going to have to be rationed, though?
Depending on what happens with the COVID spread, it's going to have to be rationed. Yeah, I would expect to see a scheme similar to what we have with the antibody drugs, where this is going to be allocated to states.
All right. Dr. Gottlieb, thank you for your analysis, as always. We're going to talk police reform up next with Senator Cory Booker. Stay with us.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than just a house. It's your home, the place that's filled with memories. The early days of figuring it out to the later years of still figuring it out. For the place you've put down roots, trust Amica Home Insurance. Amica, empathy is our best policy.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
Last Sunday, South Carolina Republican Senator Tim Scott gave us his explanation for why bipartisan negotiations on police reform collapsed. We spoke Friday to his Democratic counterpart. Senator Cory Booker told us that despite getting the Fraternal Order of Police, the country's largest police union, to support his bill, he couldn't get Republicans to do so. The last straw, he said, was when Senator Scott refused to codify former President Trump's 2020 executive orders, which required certain criteria for police departments to receive federal money. That prompted Senator Booker to walk away, something for which he says he takes full responsibility.
We were willing to take a lot less. I told my staff, we're not even going to take half a loaf. Let's take a couple slices of bread. The one area we had was on chokeholds, where there was conditions of grants and the like, but there was no other areas of agreement that we had yet established. And when we started giving some just basic lines on things that we didn't think were that great, we couldn't get the agreement there. And it's unfortunate because basically the issues that the families were asking, these are families of people that were murdered, the issues that the police officers are now standing up and agreeing with us, and by far the majority of police officers are represented by at least the FOP. What everybody was saying is, let's take a situation that just increase transparency, raise professional standards, mm-hmm. and create more accountability when an officer does something really, really against the law as well as our common values. That's what we were looking for.
So specifically, because Senator Scott was specific in his criticism, he said that you wanted police departments to hand over data to the federal government from every investigative encounter with police, including routine traffic stops. Or if they don't do that, they would risk losing money.
I think that we should be in a nation that if an officer uses physical force, whether that's a billy club, that data should be collected. Right now, we do not have a collection on these things. I think to give transparency to any town, we should start understanding what are the traffic stops, the demographics of those, and the like. We live in a country where both Senator Scott and I have had personal experiences with wrongfully stopped, being stopped by police, guns drawn on us, accused of things that we didn't do. If there's no transparency into those actions, we can't deal with it. As former manager of a city, if you can't measure it, then you can't manage it.
So given that you say you did have some areas of agreement.
We had one area agreement on chokeholds, which frankly, all across the states, red states and blue states are banning those actions.
Yeah.
We did not have enough to do the kind of data transparency that was necessary, the kind of raise in professional standards that even police officers are now saying the majority of folks who represent them. And we did not have real consequences. Remember, there are things we've been debating from the beginning about qualified immunity, other shields to holding officers that do bad things accountable.
But qualified immunity had been put to the side for the moment. Is that correct?
This is what I mean about not being willing, not sticking with the full loaf. But we did want, what the FOP and others agreed to, is some movement on the criminal standards and some movement on holding municipalities accountable for when their officers do horrible, horrible, illegal things.
So the argument that that Senator Scott was making is that doing that by saying there will be punitive action against you or you won't be eligible for those grants, it is akin to restricting funding. And he used that term, defund the police, which has frankly dogged Democrats for some time because it creates a perception of being somehow soft on crime, right? So how do you respond to that? Do you think when he is using that particular phrase in explaining why you walked away, that this is just a political game?
Again, this is a moral moment. This is not about a back and forth between Tim and I. It's a moral moment. And to get big compromise bills done, which I've accomplished before, you have to have people that are willing to take risks.
But it was Democrats who walked away twice. That's what he would say, and that's what Republicans have said. In 2020, it was Democrats who walked away from a Republican police reform bill. And this time, Democrats are walking away.
I mean, by that math, they walked away from the George Floyd bill. Remember, there was two bills put out. We were trying to do the honest, hard work of finding a compromise. Along that pathway, we did something people didn't expect. Major law enforcement organizations who are not known to agree with Democrats came to agreement, and we're not able to land it. We would not have gotten the people on the fringes. People in both parties would have disagreed with it. I will not give up on this bill because it is not a partisan issue. It is a moral issue. So, we have a problem in policing in America.
So what does that mean? Because President Biden, when he blamed Republicans, said he's going to get this done through executive action. What you're saying, it sounds like you're going to try to revive this?
I think there's a lot that President Biden is going to step up and do, and I'm excited about that. And for Washington world, I'm a baby. I've been here for 8 years. But I do know now, on the big bills that I've been able to get passed, compromise bills in the criminal justice system, it often would take more than one Congress. We are going to do this because the families deserve it. There is not enough justice in policing. Whenever we can.
I mean, we had a racial justice protest movement that shook this country.
Right.
This was an opportunity.
Yes.
We've been through two Congresses now. Are you telling us wait till after 2022?
So again, as Martin Luther King would say, how long? people have been told to wait. Justice delayed is justice denied. And for those families I've talked to over the last weeks, they are rightfully impatient. I cannot change the minds of some Republicans, but I've got enough momentum now that I'm going to continue to work. I can't tell you when, but I will tell you this. We have already seen progress from Kentucky to Colorado. We have seen the activism of people in the streets demanding it create real substantive change. We offered in these negotiations.
But if Democrats lose the majority in 2022, you think you are more likely to get the kind of change you want?
I don't know what it is. I'm telling you, I'm not giving up. And again, law enforcement leaders will tell you this, where we have a lot of work to do so that everybody doesn't feel like I felt growing up, and a lot of kids do, is when you see a police officer, your first instinct is fear and not like, hey, there's somebody here to help me. And so we need to create transparency, accountability, and raise professional standards. The majority of police officers, at least the unions that represent them, agree with us now. We have more work to do to get this done.
Senator Scott says he's at the table. Will you come back to it, or are talks completely dead at the moment?
Again, Senator Scott and I actually are friends. And so I'm more than confident, especially as I look at other Republicans there and other folks to deal with, that we're going to find a way to keep working on this issue. We came to a stalemate. when we couldn't embody Donald Trump's EO in legislation as is, that's problematic for me. But again, this is going to continue to be an urgency in my life. And as a person who has been able to deliver significant reform in the criminal justice space, I'm going to continue to work on this. And America, police officers, as we're now seeing, conservative think tanks, all mm-hmm. are calling for change. We're going to build on that coalition, and I believe we're going to get this done.
Senator Booker, thank you for your time.
No, thank you very much.
Americans seem to be increasingly splintered these days, and now that anger and partisanship is impacting our children.
We know who you are, but we will find you, and we know
you will never be allowed in public again.
Attention, angry American parents, your children, and the rest of the country are watching. Scenes like this outside a school board meeting in Tennessee last month, or this one in Idaho, where anti-mask protesters caused local officials to cancel their meeting due to safety concerns, triggered an unusual emergency request for federal assistance to stop violence against public school children, board members, and local educators. In a letter to President Biden, the National School Board Association appealed for help.
These threats to school board members is horrible. They're doing their jobs.
The board compared the angry eruptions to domestic terrorism and hate crimes. It isn't clear what the feds can actually do about the basic lack of respect and civility plaguing communities right now.
Show some respect.
The spate of physical attacks on flight attendants enforcing mask rules is just another example of self-righteous adults behaving badly. It seems the anxiety caused by the pandemic has made it even harder for many of our fellow Americans to listen to each other and to forget how to have a civil conversation about difficult issues. At least 8 states have enacted legal bans on teachers even discussing theories regarding race-based privilege. Racial equity is one of the most explosive topics at school board gatherings. It is dangerous to our children when the parents themselves are the school bullies. It poses a threat to the very foundational levels of our democracy, basic education. Not every act needs to be political. Putting a mask on your child amidst the pandemic is just practical.
Avoiding masks is not in the Bible, but taking care of others is.
As this Tennessee dad explained to his kindergartner.
She went to school and was one of just a few kids in her class wearing a mask, which made her ask me why she had to. My answer was because we want to take care of other people. She's 5 years old, but she understood that concept. And it's disappointing that more adults around here can't seem to grasp it.
Perhaps the children could teach us a thing or two about civic duty. We'll be right back.
We all have busy lives these days, and we don't want to waste a day recovering after a night out. That's why ZBiotics is the answer we've all been looking for. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. This is a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. Enhance your mornings with ZBiotics. Go to ZBiotics.com/CBS to get 15% off your first order when you use code CBS at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. No questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/CBS and use the code CBS at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
That's it for us today. Thank you for watching. For Face the Nation, I'm Margaret Brennan. Today's guests were New York Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez,
White House Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci, West Virginia Republican Governor Jim Justice, former FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb, and New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker. The executive producer of Face the Nation's Mary Hager. The broadcast was directed by Shelley Schwartz. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network CBSN at 10:30 a.m., 1 p.m., and 4 p.m. Eastern every Sunday.
If you like Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
The Hargan women seem to have it all.
From the outside looking in, we were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But as detectives would soon learn, there was a lot going on inside the Hargan household.
Ashley and I have been calling my mom and the house and Helen. Okay. No one's answering.
63-year-old Pamela Hargan gunned down in her own home. Her youngest daughter, Helen, lay dead upstairs.
Patrol, when they arrived, assumed or thought that there might have been a murder-suicide.
But for the detectives on the scene...
There were things about the scene itself that were concerning to us on day one.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister?
There is no boogeyman here. It is exactly who we think it is.
I'm Peter Van Sant from 48 Hours. This is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Survivor 46 is here, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast, and we have a twist this season. The winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares, will be joining us every week.
We're going behind the scenes of the biggest moments, the how and the why things happen, and the strategy and analysis you can only get from someone like me, a Survivor winner.
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.